The Oracle Network.
Riddle Me That is a true crime podcast that deals with adult themes. Some episodes explore disturbing topics such as murder, abuse, sexual violence, drug abuse, suicide, and self-harm. Please listen at your own risk. Theories discussed in episodes may not be the opinion of the host.
Welcome back to part four of our coverage, the conclusion on the unsolved murder of Faith Hedgepeth. I'm again joined by Chelsea from Crime and Crime Again podcast. Are you ready to jump back into it, Chels?
Yeah, let's get back into it.
So remember when I told you to put a pin in the voicemail that Faith likely pocket dialed to her friend Una Chavez? Well, we're going to get into that now. So it wasn't released until 2016, and there is some debate if the 1:23 a.m. timestamp is correct. And again, I will say this is not a hard science. Like there is some science to it, audio engineering, but this is kind of an interpretation of the audio that's been enhanced. So please, for that reason, form your own conclusions based on the subjective nature of this evidence. Experts believe, due to a glitch in the phone, the timestamp is incorrect and that the audio captured could have been that of Faith's murder. This was apparently very common at the time, this glitch. So Una had originally deleted the voicemail, believing it to be just another pocket dial from Faith. So this was apparently something she did on a regular basis. But after Una found out about Faith's murder, she hurriedly contacted her cell phone carrier and she had the message restored. At that point, she just turned it over to the authorities, hoping that it would help in their investigation. I love that she did this. Una Chavez sounds like such a good friend.
It's amazing that she had the presence of mind to immediately think back, oh my God, maybe that voicemail that I got, I should go get that.
Yeah, I love that she did that. She's just this logical presence of mind throughout this whole story. She seems to provide such great insights and she really seemed to care about Faith. Earlier in the story, when she seemed to be kind of like she'd had it with Karina and wanted to get out of that situation of living with her, who did she go to have an alternate living situation? She went and talked to Una Chavez.
Yeah, I think Una offers a lot of insight into Faith as a person, just what was going on privately in Faith's life, and maybe not so much like what we've heard about her and Karina.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a different layer to their friendship and maybe just this different dimension of Faith that Una was privy to that maybe the public isn't privy to and maybe we don't see in this relationship with Karina. I don't know how long they were friends for, but Una Chavez was also an Indigenous woman, right? Like they were pledging the same sorority, correct?
I'm not positive about whether Una was Indigenous, but I think she did say that they met freshman year of college. I think it was her that said that when she first met Faith, they were walking into a class at the same time, and Faith was just so nice and welcoming and bubbly.
Yeah, maybe I'm just remembering incorrectly, thinking that they both pledged this sorority that I think was largely that of Indigenous women. I can't remember what exactly was the name of this sorority, but it seemed like it was something that I think the two of them were potentially going to do together.
So I just did a quick Google. The sorority is Alpha Pi Omega that Una Chavez and Faith were pledging. And it was just the day prior to Faith being murdered. And it was a Native American sorority, and it's the oldest one in the country. And Faith was posthumously made an honorary member. So I thought that was really interesting.
So back to this pocket dial. So in a segment from Crime Watch Daily, they break down the phone call. I'll link it in the show notes. And it's titled Faith Hedgepeth Murder Investigation Part 4, the audio recording. So I'm going to give an overview here of what forensic audio expert Arlo West found, who, believe it or not, specializes in pocket dial phone conversations. So that's actually a thing.
I've noticed just from my interest in true crime and watching documentaries and listening to podcasts and doing my own research for episodes, there are a lot of very specific niche specializations in the world.
Yeah, I think I only really realized that when you kind of get into the true crime sphere and you realize that there are these people that have these very specific kind of subspecialties. And Arlo West has a pretty impressive resume. Did you hear him on the Crime Weekly episode where he was talking, they went over his resume and the guy has some serious credentials. Like he's obviously the foremost expert in this specific thing in, you know, pocket dials. He's got his degree in audio engineering and a bunch of other things as well. He's very, very accomplished, and he clearly knows what he's doing, whether you agree with him or not.
Yeah, I would say he definitely has some really valuable insight to offer to this, especially where this is a case where there is that one little detail, that one specific thing, that voicemail that they dredged up.
So Arlo has, according to him, worked on hundreds, perhaps even thousands of criminal cases, notably that of Diane Saunders, where his analysis was essential to her conviction for the murder of her boyfriend, David King. So Arlo cleaned up the audio from a recording device, audio that had previously been sent to the FBI to no avail, and he managed to recover 80% of what was said by Diane. So in the end, the state secured a murder conviction, largely due to the work that Arlo West had done. So it isn't that he's some like fringe, unreliable expert. Arlo appeared to be the very best at what he's doing. But I just wanted to make that clear, because I think there's points that Chelsea and I aren't experts, but we may disagree with his conclusions. So we just really want to make that clear so you can draw your own conclusions based on this evidence.
That's the thing with the audio evidence, is this, even when it's cleaned up, it's still so difficult to make out, and it's hard to really decipher what you're hearing. So there are points where I'm not sure if I hear what Arlo hears, but I can see how he hears it.
Yeah, I feel like I've got a case of confirmation bias when I listen to this audio, because we're going to go through the contents of the audio. We're not going to play it because it's incredibly garbled. You can hear it on that segment of Crime Watch Daily, which I'm going to link, but there's very little that you can deduce from the original raw audio. So, you know, you can definitely listen to that, but I'm not going to force it upon anybody who doesn't want to hear it. So we're going to go through what Arlo thinks he hears. But I think that when I think that Arlo hears it, that seed's already planted to me. So how much I actually independently would think that I heard that if he didn't already suggest it, I can't say for sure. So just keeping in mind that I may potentially be coming to this with that inherent bias, that you're basically confirming what you've already heard and what this expert is suggesting. So Arlo believes that Faith says, ow. And this one seems pretty clear to me. It's distinct. Did you hear this?
I think I could hear it. It was really short. It was like just a snippet of a syllable. And it's, like we said, it's really, really garbled. So it's like, you can hear the tone in the voices for sure. Like we mentioned this earlier, the tone definitely seems tense. Voices definitely seem raised. But do we know if that's because there is something heated going on, or is it because are they in the club? Is that where the call was really made from and they're trying to talk over music? It's really difficult to decipher.
So next, Arlo believes that Faith says, help me. It's really pitchy, but it does sound like it could be help me.
I agree with that one. It does sound like a feminine voice saying help me.
So next, Arlo believes he hears a man saying, I think she's dying. Personally, this one's a little harder to decipher. When I see the printed words, I hear it, but without the words underneath, I'd have difficulty.
This reminds me a lot of, if you've seen those TikToks where they play music, they'll play a soundbite and they'll have the words that it sounds like, and then they'll put a different word next and they'll let it go and you can hear that. And then they'll put a different word in the same soundbite. You hear that now. So I think that's what that reminds me of, and I can definitely see that.
Yeah, so that's what it's so hard to know. Like when coming in and you're looking at this, you're reading the word, do you then have confirmation bias? But you don't realize that you're necessarily doing it. So that's where I've got a hard time knowing how much, if I just independently heard this without the words underneath and without him guiding me along, if I would hear that. That one, I don't think I would personally. I'm not saying it's not there. I just don't think I'd hear it.
Yeah, that one is especially garbled. I didn't think that's what I heard when I heard that playing.
So Faith then says, according to Arlo, let me go, help me. I hear this one pretty clearly. It's easy to see how he drew this specific conclusion. So it's clear that his analysis is beginning to paint a picture of an altercation that is potentially violent, as Faith has, according to Arlo, used an emotive voice and is clearly in pain. Arlo then believes he hears another female voice say, don't be a bitch, put up a fight. I can hear this as well, though I don't know if, again, I would be able to decipher it without the written word underneath. Arlo notes the second female is very angry. She then goes on to say, I'm going to kick your face, bitch. I figured out that's It seems that one female is angry at the other, possibly over a man, because she says something else after. I figured out that's something based solely on what Arlo had recovered. What did you think of these?
For most of us, I think the first time we're hearing this is we are seeing the captions. We're seeing directly what we're supposed to be hearing. So I think that does kind of contribute to that confirmation bias. So it's hard to decide, am I really hearing this or am I hearing it because I'm seeing it in front of my face?
That's where I have an issue too. It's like, I hear it, but I think that I'm being influenced by the written word. And I think we're influenced on a deep psychological level that we're not consciously aware of. So that's where it's really difficult. How much would we actually hear if we didn't see these words there? I have a feeling it would be a lot less, but I can't say how much less. And I can't then separate myself and listen to it without, because those seeds are already planted. So it's really tough to tell, but it does sound, I will agree with you, it's very tense. It does seem to be a fight of some sort. I don't know if she's actually in pain or if there's any violence. Maybe there was an arm grabbed, maybe something worse. I have no idea. I just don't know. I mean, it does seem like this could be very easily an argument that two women could get into in a club, though.
Yeah, going back to Faith possibly saying ow towards the beginning of the recording, I was thinking about, okay, so she used to say, oh, you're stupid, like joking, like playful. Could she have been like, you know, how college kids, people around that age group, like when they're flirting, could she have been flirting with someone and like a guy maybe playfully tapped her and she went, ow, like being flirty? Or like, was it like tense at that point? Or are we already going into listening to this thinking it is tense and heated because we know what happens to Faith so soon after that?
Well, we know who was there that night. Maybe could have been a jealousy thing, because we know Brandon Edwards was there, according to Brandon Edwards. He posted that on his Facebook saying, you know, I told you to be careful that night when you went home. So that's indicative of somebody who was at the thrill. He's telling Faith to be careful, you know, to have a good night. In that post, she's saying, you know, I love you type thing. This is somebody who clearly had a close relationship with Faith, but it's somebody that seemed to be also hooking up with, potentially hooking up with Karina. So I don't know how much overlap there was here or how much hurt feelings or potential jealousy there could have been, but maybe Brandon was flirting with Faith at the club and then maybe Karina didn't like it. I really have no idea. But again, we've got Brandon Edwards coming into it here.
And I believe the guys that they were seen with at the club, were these new guys they were communicating with, being friendly with, or were they people who had previously already been around them? Because that may add a new kind of element to the jealousy possibility. Was it something where these two girls went out, they were going out with these guys, some new interests possibly, and, you know, they were new to the whole mix. So was there that jealousy that broke out?
I don't think that they were new. I think they were connected to Eric somehow. I've even heard from someone that Eric was actually at the club, but I haven't heard that substantiated. So I am unsure. I only know I can say Brandon was there because Brandon says he was there. But I'd heard that maybe one of Eric's cousins or somebody was in that group of guys. But I can't say specifically who these people were. But I don't think they were necessarily new. But maybe they were. Maybe a couple of them were. It's so hard to know because there's this club full of people. And just because they're seen with these couple guys, it doesn't mean that this argument didn't break out over these other couple of guys. We don't know. Maybe it had nothing to do with the people that were actually present. Maybe Faith just walked by somebody and Karina was mad or whatever. And she was like, oh, you know, I saw what you did there type of thing. It's just interesting that Brandon pops up again. We've got him maybe sleeping over on a couch. We know he's present at the club. We know that he's talking to Faith and he's in communication with her at the club because he says that he tells her to be careful going home. So if there is this overlap, if there is this potential jealousy over Brandon Edwards, that could have kicked it off. But I mean, anything could have kicked it off. It could have been somebody new. It could have been whatever. We're even just assuming that something kicked off, right? Like we're just speculating that this is indeed correct. And this was a fight potentially between Karina and Faith.
Yeah. And it's possible we keep going back to the jealousy thing because we hear the tense voices, we hear the female tense voices. And then we think about that note where jealous was written blatantly as an issue. And then now I'm thinking about Brandon. If he did say, oh, I told you to be careful that night, did he have someone in mind specifically that he was telling Faith to be careful around? Was it one of these guys that was possibly connected to Eric? And would those guys also, I know Faith and Eric were not friendly whatsoever, quite the opposite. So were any of these guys new to Faith's circle? Not to Karina's, maybe, but to Faith's, and maybe she had a new interest. And maybe some jealousy broke out with that.
Or maybe Brandon Edwards was just kind of on the periphery witnessing this altercation between Faith and Karina. And he's like, hey, you know, be careful going home. That puts some context to it when you see these two girls, if they are indeed fighting, whether he's in the middle of it or he's not, right? Whether he's the reason they're fighting or he isn't, he clearly cared about Faith. You know, we got her initials tattooed on him. He said in that Facebook post that he loved her. So I think there was obviously some kind of feelings, whether platonic or romantic, we can't say for sure. So he's obviously concerned about her enough to tell her to be careful. So I would think one could potentially assume that he may have witnessed something that would make him say something like, be careful. But I mean, also, she is a tipsy college girl heading home with Karina. They're driving home, right? So after potentially having a couple drinks, saying be careful isn't a weird thing to say when someone could be drinking and driving as well.
And with the Brandon being possibly skeptical of Karina thing, we know he didn't answer her phone calls at all. So does he already have these negative thoughts about Karina? Does he already keep his eye out on her? Does he already think, Faith, I don't know that, you know, I don't know that this relationship is super positive for you?
Maybe that's why Brandon wasn't answering Karina's calls. Maybe he witnessed what happened between Faith and Karina, and he wasn't too keen on pursuing anything with Karina after that. He was like, eh, you know, I'm going to side with Faith on this or whatever. It just seems like that's interesting. He has this interaction with Faith. It's clear that he says, you know, we spoke right before. And right after that, Karina's messaging him and he's not answering her. Maybe after what he saw, he wants nothing to do with it, right? Karina needs you more than you know is what's sent from Faith's phone. So like, that's a weird thing in the context of what we, you know, come to know about this sort of convoluted friendship between her and Brandon Edwards. So did he see something and at the club, and there's a reason why he's ignoring Karina? I think that at least opens up the potential when we couple this audio, if it did indeed happen at the club, and then Brandon says, be careful. I mean, he could have just been saying, be careful, because he didn't want her to drink and drive, or it could have been directly tied to something he witnessed between Faith and Karina. So that could have been enough for him to go, I want nothing to do with her. I'm not answering her calls, even if it is just for a booty call at whatever time. So back to the phone call, Arlo notes that there isn't one male present, but there's actually two. So at one point, one of the males says, to our next victim, according to Arlo, and the female responds, all right. The other male says, just throw it in the river, according to Arlo. I don't know what the context of any of this would be about. It sounds absolutely chilling, but what are your thoughts?
It is unsettling at first listen, I guess, but also it just seems kind of out of place. It seems really like a jump, like to the next thing really quickly. Like, how did we get here?
So earlier in the attack, one of the males says, I think she's dying. And the other one responds, do it anyhow. I mean, this sounds awful. Some people believe this happened during Faith's murder, that the timestamp was wrong. This makes much more sense in the context of it being involved in her murder. But if this is at the club, I think she's dying. The other responds, do it anyhow. I mean, I don't really know what this could mean, right? It just doesn't really seem to make sense in the context of a club, especially if there's tense voices. If they were laughing, it could be like, oh, I think she's dying, right? You know, when somebody's maybe had too much to drink and they're like, give me another shot. And they're like, ah, do it anyhow. You could see how somebody could joke around maybe in that context, but it seems like this is an extremely tense exchange. So I don't really know what to make of this. Do you?
I don't. Again, it seems out of place. It seems like a really quick jump. And I think it would make more sense what you said, like being at a club, you know, taking shot after shot after shot. And you know how people joke around. That would make more sense to me. I don't know. The timestamp really gets me. And we'll get to it here in a minute as to why the timestamp. I feel like maybe it is right. Maybe it was at that time.
Yeah, I'm just more inclined to believe this was at the club. It just seems like, yeah, you don't hear the clinking of glasses, but people have refuted that. And they've said, like, you know, we'll get into it more, but they've said that there's reasons for that. This is the type of club that you go to the bar and get your drinks. A waitress doesn't drop them off. So I don't know. Next, the female who is believed to be Faith says, "My hands are on fire, help." This seems to refer to Faith's hands potentially being tied or held. But I mean, if two females are in a fight at a club, one could be holding one's hands in front of her. Like, say somebody goes to slap the other one, and the friend could hold the hands in front of her so that she couldn't slap her, or she couldn't do anything, or she couldn't leave. If you're holding somebody by the wrists, somebody could easily say, "My hands are on fire, help." But this part, just personally, I don't know. It doesn't really fit for me.
The only way I could see it fitting is if maybe the hands part was misheard and we go back to maybe they were taking shots. Maybe something else was on fire. Was her throat on fire? Was she shooting, you know, I know shooting fireball in the past. That's not a fun experience. Mm-hmm. That feels like fire. So could it have been that kind of reference?
It's just we go back to the tense atmosphere and then one reportedly responds, "I'll untie them. Her hands look like they're on fire," which I get it could be something like a shot or whatever, but then I don't know how to tie this to the context of a shot or one's stomach being on fire. "I'll untie them. Her hands look like they're on fire." It's just, I don't get what this means if they are indeed in a club and this is indeed what is said. So it's potentially backed up by the autopsy report. So there was bruising and cuts on Faith's hands. So it's possible they could have felt as though they were on fire, but we're making a big leap, even assuming that this call was around Faith's murder and not at the club.
I think a lot of this can be chalked up to a lot of things being misheard or misinterpreted. I think the context of looking at it, like, this girl was brutally murdered just after this, like just hours after this. Is that influencing what people are agreeing with hearing here? Like, it, I feel like I would be more inclined to believe a lot of what might be being heard here if it made sense. Some of it just seems like words strung together that don't actually make any sense.
Yeah, that's what I've got a hard time with too. And because we're looking at this, like you said, in the context of Faith's murder, and then we're also seeing the letter, like the words typed above it when he's deciphering it, I think it's 100% influencing the way that I'm interpreting the call and the words that are said. And I don't think we can help that. All we can really do is be very cognizant of the fact that these type of things will influence confirmation bias. So I don't know. He's the expert on this. I'm not. I just don't know how much of it is accurate and how much of it actually really fits and how much may be inaccurate. And I'm sure that does happen with pocket dials. So at one point there's rapping. Arlo believes that this is a person who's present singing along to T-Pain's song "Booty Work." He doesn't believe this is at the club, as like I said earlier, there's no sign of clinking glasses, there's no low-end bass, no musical content or background chatter that is typical in calls made from crowded restaurants or bars. The rapping seems to be, according to Arlo, an attempt to mask Faith's cries for help.
So in this context, this was kind of weird to me. I thought about it, I was like, okay, maybe that is what he's hearing. And then I pictured it for a second. I can't buy that I'm being told that someone is being brutally murdered and beaten to death, and there's just some guy in the corner for no reason rapping "Booty Work" by T-Pain. Like, when you hear that played back, like, if I'm not looking at the audio, I did look away a little bit at when the video was playing with the captions, just so I could see if maybe I could hear something else. And when they play it, I wasn't sure what song it was. It sounded like music for sure, really garbled music. I wasn't sure what song it was until they played it. They figured out what song it was. And I was like, okay, that is for sure "Booty Work" playing in the background at a club.
Yeah. And when you put it like that, it's a little bizarre. If you're going to carefully orchestrate this murder that he's saying there's at least three other people involved, if you're going to go and do that and you want to mask the sounds of somebody who you're thinking about killing, you'd think you'd put on music and not have some dude just start impromptu rapping "Booty Work." It's just like a little bizarre. It's like at this moment, somebody is like, "Hey, she's too loud. Okay, well, I will start rapping "Booty Work." I don't believe that that happened. It just sounds so implausible. So one of the males refers to Rosie. So that's supposedly a nickname of Karina Rosario. So that's especially intriguing. Eric is also heard in the recording. I clearly hear Rosie when one of the males says, "I can't believe you really did it, Rosie." Do you hear that?
I can hear Rosie, and it definitely makes sense when you think about, okay, her name is Rosario, and that's, you know, they're in college. People make up nicknames for each other all the time. But does it have anything to do with Faith? Are they talking, again, they're in a club. Are we going back to, are they talking about taking shots? Are they just being crazy and wild that night, and they just think it's great, and they're just having a great time?
Maybe Karina just got on the bar and started twerking, and they're like, "I can't believe you did it, Rosie." Who knows, right? This is a college bar. "I can't believe you did it, Rosie" could mean any number of things. It doesn't necessarily mean that "I can't believe you did it, Rosie, you killed Faith." I mean, it's one way, and it's a chilling way to interpret it if we think this happened around the murder. But I mean, what did Rosie do? If we're thinking about it in that particular context, we already are influenced by the murder, and then we're interpreting these words. So does this mean what we think it means? I clearly hear Rosie, but I don't know if I can attach any more significance to it than that.
Yeah, I think this whole call would make a lot more sense if there was any real context to it. And if it wasn't just kind of, it's almost like cherry picking out words that can kind of be heard maybe, and then stringing them together.
Yeah, I agree. It's just, and I'm not saying that Arlo West isn't, you know, amazing at what he does, and he isn't the foremost expert in his field, because he absolutely is. But there is a subjective nature to this, I think. And if there wasn't, it would be taken as 100% fact, like DNA evidence is taken to identify another human being, but it just isn't. Police believe that Faith was murdered around 4:30 a.m., though, of course, it's possible that she was murdered closer to 3 a.m. when Faith and Karina arrived back at the apartment, as the phone calls and texts to Brandon Edwards happened at 3:40 a.m. Also, the neighbor heard loud thumping sounds around 3 a.m., so it's possible that the timestamp is off anywhere from an hour to hour and a half to 3 hours. Arlo West says that was a known software glitch at the time with iPhones, and that timestamping in 2012 was problematic. And I personally know nothing about the timestamps in 2012 with iPhones. He's the expert, but I don't know. I don't think that this call happened at the apartment. It just doesn't sound like it's the most likely scenario to me personally.
I agree. I think hearing the music really solidified it. When they played it over, I was like, that is at a club. They're talking loud. They could be heated and tense, but they're talking loud because they're at a club. And you can hear the music. Again, it's garbled. The phone's probably in a pocket or maybe even in a purse.
So the Chapel Hill police believe the timestamp to be accurate, and that they believe the pocket dial was made from the club. So at least this is what they've said publicly, as they believe there to be background music indicative of a club, aka T-Pain's Booty Work. Though some have said at the Thrill, you wouldn't hear waitresses and clinking glasses, as I just mentioned, as people went to the bar and they served themselves. Well, they didn't serve themselves. A bartender served them. That would be dangerous if you had college students just serving themselves booze. But this still doesn't explain the lack of music, I guess low-end bass detected by Arlo in the background. Again, I really can't give an opinion on that specific thing because I don't know what should be heard in those. I guess it's just hearing the music and not hearing the thumping of the bass. I guess, like, you know, you go to a club, it's like, but it does sound like the music is pretty garbled. So I don't know how much of the bass would be absorbed when that phone is in her pocket or in her purse. But again, he's the pocket dial expert, so I think he would know how much bass to assign to a club. So it's a big question mark for me.
Yeah, I know during my digging, I kind of looked, when they deciphered the song, I kind of looked and I was like, okay, how popular was the song at that time? Because you can kind of tell, like, they're going to play popular songs mostly for college kids, what they're listening to, and then there might be some older ones. And Booty Work was released in 2011, so just the year before. And then I also wondered, of course, we're not the experts here, but I also wonder, though, a lot of people in my digging have said that that club at the time wasn't really what you would consider a nightclub. It was kind of more like a bar type thing for college kids. You know, at nightclubs, you're going to hear that loud, that bass from the music. But do we know how great the sound system here was? Do we know if they would have had, if we should have been hearing that bass at that quote unquote club?
I've got to imagine that he looked into those variables. I would think like he's as much of an audio scientist as one can be an audio scientist, right? Being an audio engineer and having the qualifications that he does. I would like to think that he plugged those variables into his analysis of this audio, and he would have looked into these sorts of things and kind of found a baseline for what should be heard. But I really can't say for sure. But it is a really good point, though. I mean, if it is a bar versus a club, because a club, you're going to have such overwhelming bass. But if this is a bar, it just really does depend on the bar. Not all bars have really, really loud music playing. Some of them will be slightly quieter. You can sometimes talk a little bit easier. You don't have to talk over the music, whereas at a club, you can rarely talk. You've got to scream into somebody's ear.
Yeah, and I know a lot of like bar and grill type places that you might go to, even those aren't very loud. It's just kind of like there's no bass to it. It's just kind of playing on some speakers.
Okay, so I'm looking at some pictures here. They've got like the black light in there, so everything looks blue. It's 157 East Rosemary Street, Chapel Hill, I think. The Thrill, and there's a picture of it. It almost looks like this industrial building. They've got all these t-shirts made for it called Chapel Thrill, but there's not a lot of inside pictures.
I think Stephanie said in the Crime Weekly, she said that they had closed down. It's a different type of building now, but she did do a little bit of digging through their Facebook, their old Facebook posts. Like she scrolled for quite a while and she said that that night they were apparently hosting some cheerleaders, I think from maybe UNC that night. But she did say that they were permanently closed and it's something else.
They've got Yelp reviews from 2014, two reviews of The Thrill. They've got an average of 1.5 stars. So, and that might tell you everything you need to know. So as mentioned previously, Arlo West discounted the possibility that this call took place in a club, believing there was no bass, no drums, no keyboards or synthesizers, that the music was someone rapping, not music playing at a club. It was the belief of the Chapel Hill police that the initial timestamp was indeed accurate, but that didn't stop them from having Arlo West give them the transcripts of his analysis of the phone conversation, which Arlo believes captures Faith's murder and he believes may be pivotal in solving her murder.
I would agree with him in that it could be pivotal in solving the murder. I just don't think it took place during the murder. I think the voices heard in this call could be key players in what happened to her just a couple hours later. But I really think the timestamp is accurate, and I do think that it took place in the club and it was a pocket dial.
I 100% agree. I think it could be pivotal because this is potentially an altercation that Karina got into hours before her death, right before her death. So is it important? I think absolutely. Does it capture her murder? Not in my personal opinion. I think that the timestamp and what the Chapel Hill police believe that it is an accurate timestamp, that's also my personal belief. So I encourage you all to go and listen to the recording. Obviously, Arlo West's credentials speak for themselves. So if you're familiar with this case, then I know you've seen the computer-generated image of a man created from the DNA found at the scene by Parabon Nanolabs. This was revolutionary at the time, as phenotyping was relatively new to crime scene analysis. So this is a process of predicting physical characteristics based on DNA through a snapshot in 2016. So what this snapshot is essentially a mock-up or blueprint that shows us what someone may look like. So there are other factors that are difficult to predict, such as weight and exact height, as outside variables contribute to these. Through snapshot, Parabon Nanolab said the man had dark hair, olive skin, he likely had brown or hazel eyes, and was possibly Hispanic or Native American with European mixed ancestry. Their profile also couldn't tell age and specific hairstyle.
And we come back to that DNA where it's so convoluted. We don't really know what to make of it. Is this anything to do with, again, Faith's actual murder? Or is it just someone who had been in the apartment? Like, we're talking about, you know, possible trace DNA on her back, male DNA on the bag, male DNA on other things. But again, it's hard to decipher what I think about it because there were just regular visitors in the apartment. And do we know if it had anything to actually do with Faith's murder?
And I think that's what's so convoluted and confusing, right? Is we know there's the male DNA on the bottle. We know it's on the note. We know it's on Faith and we know it's all the same profile, but we don't know when it got there. I want to know, maybe there's specific fingerprints, or maybe there's DNA on top of the blood, or maybe there was a mixed profiles. Maybe this individual got cut as well. I just don't know what specific type of DNA is on that bottle with regards to the male DNA. But it makes me think that it can't be that compelling because of Derek Levasseur's stance on it. And he is really like one of the foremost experts on the Faith Hedgepeth case. So I don't find it nearly as compelling as I think that I would have at first glance. You know, they're saying that she's raped, and then they're saying there's a male profile that ties all of these things together. So without knowing that there isn't seminal fluid inside Faith, and without knowing that it could have just been found on her back, I think this sounds a lot more compelling than it may actually be. It could just be this one thing that's this major obstacle in them ever bringing charges against anyone else because they've got this phantom male DNA profile.
And it kind of contradicts other things that have been said by authorities about the case. They believed it to be someone who was connected with Faith somehow, who knew her, not a stranger, not a random attack. And yet this snapshot doesn't really look like anybody who was in her life, or that we've seen at least at the time.
Yeah, it's such a strange thing. And is it a red herring? I mean, they had to have known all the men that Karina and Faith were in contact with. They had their cell phones. They had their communications. So the fact that this person very well could have been one of those individuals that declined to give their DNA. And we know that there's been a few of them, right? So it seems likely, given the fact they think they've tested thousands of guys, like checked thousands of DNA profiles. This has been an extremely expensive endeavor trying to find out who the murderer of Faith Hedgepeth is. And the fact that they've cast this wide net, tested all these men, and they've not found the contributor for this DNA, it feels like it's potentially one of these individuals that was close to her that declined to give their profile. Because if you had indeed either maybe eaten a meal with Faith or Karina, drank with them that night, like a couple nights prior, there, you know that you'd slept with them. So there's semen on the bed. And so you know that your DNA profile is there. So what would you potentially have to gain by giving your DNA? It's only going to tie you to the scene.
That's what I was just thinking about. Like, maybe they are innocent of the murder, whoever is declining the DNA, and they just don't want to give it because they know that's going to make them look bad, because it's going to put them there. But I also just find it weird that there's no mention of any other DNA profiles in the apartment. It's just that one that they have publicized and keep talking about and are apparently convinced is involved in Faith's murder. And I think I saw on one of the documentaries, I think either someone from campus police or Chapel Hill police said they had taken DNA samples from 800 some odd people.
Remember, like, hearing thousands somewhere, but that could have been an exaggeration. But I mean, at this point, it's been so long, so who knows how many they've taken. But either way, it was a lot of samples. But I think there's potential that maybe the sheets were washed and then there'd been only one male who'd come over either seeing Faith or seeing Karina. And that person was like, crap. Maybe they went to a lawyer and were like, I was there, and this is the context which I was there. I drank with her. And then they know what's been seized from the apartment. And that lawyer's like, you better not give your DNA, because that's not going to help you. It's only going to implicate you. We've got your DNA on the murder weapon. We've got your DNA found on her body, on in or around her body, but I think on her back, because that's what Derek had said. Then we also have it on this pen. It's just, this person is tied to the scene, and it seems like it's going to be a pretty hard hole to dig yourself out of. And we know how juries love DNA evidence. So I could see how any good lawyer would be like, do not give your DNA.
Yeah, it's wild to think that they have tested that many people and none of them have come back a match for that specific DNA profile. So it makes you think either it's someone who's not giving the DNA, or it's someone who maybe didn't actually leave any incriminating DNA behind. And that's why it was so easy to set up as like a staged crime scene, or try to hopefully pin it on somebody else.
Yeah, exactly. And who would know that there'd been guys over there? Well, Eric Tecoy Jones might know, because he's living in the same complex. And I'm not saying he was a stalker and spying on them, but there is the potential that him or his friends or relatives or whomever is actually living in that apartment that he went and stayed at, they may have been watching and said, hey, I saw a guy go in there. And he's somebody who lived with Karina. He may be aware of how often she does or does not wash her sheets. So he may know, hey, there could be another DNA profile. If I'm very careful, I'm not going to be tied to this scene, but somebody else will be. Either that or somebody like Karina would have the knowledge that there's been a male DNA profile there. And so that could basically throw a wrench into any prosecution's attempt to bring charges against her if she is indeed involved. So as we mentioned earlier, Eric Tocoi Jones wasn't a match for the DNA found at the scene. So DNA was taken from Ronnie L. Edwards, obviously remember him, the man who was possibly related to Brandon Edwards and whose vehicle was part of the search warrant where the police collected evidence. So that wasn't it for DNA collection. The police cast, like I said, a very wide net. They checked the DNA of the men that they could track down who were in attendance at the Thrill on the early morning hours of September 7th, 2012. There were no matches. They've reportedly been thousands or hundreds. I'm unsure of the exact number because I'd read thousands. Shell said this person said 800. I don't know where they're at in 2021, honestly, but there's been a lot of men tested. So it would be interesting to know if authorities are using forensic genealogy to track down the killer, because it seems likely that somewhere in this wide net, they caught someone who's related to this killer.
That's something that I didn't consider before. Have they tried that route? Because we've seen so many cases lately being solved with genetic genealogy. Like the biggest one, of course, was the Golden State Killer. That's what really kind of got the ball rolling, I think, where people were like, wow, this could actually solve so many cold cases. And now it's almost like every month now we're seeing cases like that that are decades old. And they've finally closed it. They finally found who did it.
Yeah, I really hope that they apply this. I mean, if this is somebody who's from out of state, maybe they're going to school out of state, they don't have any family members nearby. Maybe in that the samples that they collected, they wouldn't find someone who was related. But if they cast a wider net and they put it into GEDmatch, maybe then they'd be able to find somebody who was related to this unknown male DNA profile. And again, even if they do, I guess that's sort of the gamble, right? If this person isn't involved and a lawyer has advised them not to give their DNA, they probably know that there is a chance that it could be put into GEDmatch and maybe one of this individual's relatives could have put their DNA out there. So you're taking this chance between trying to explain the presence of your DNA, like you're gambling. If you're trying to explain the presence saying, I had nothing to do with the murder, this is why my DNA is there, and coming forward with that information, versus holding it back and then being tied to it. And then you're behind the eight ball. You're trying to explain something after the fact. And it always makes somebody look guilty. You know what I mean?
I agree. I think any way that whoever's DNA that is, it's going to make them look guilty. Even if they had come forward before and been forthcoming with the information at the start, it still would have made them look bad either way you look at it, because it would have cast that suspicion on them from the get-go. And now if they come forward with it after the fact, it's really going to make them look bad.
And it sounds like the Chapel Hill police are really good, but I think a lot of police departments, if armed with that kind of information, there's a lot of public pressure to close this case, to know who this boogeyman is. So if you have a DNA profile that matches, I think you're very likely going to get a prosecutor who's going to want to take this to trial, because it's such a high profile case. It's like, hey, let's just take it to a jury, see what a jury thinks. If a jury thinks this is compelling enough to convict, then cool, we've closed the case on the Faith Hedgepeth case. But I just don't think there's any good way to look at this DNA. And even if this person is indeed innocent, I can completely understand why they're going, okay, I'm just going to sit back, probably on the advice of my lawyer, take the gamble, hope that one of my relatives hasn't put their DNA into GEDmatch and that they don't match me along the way, because explaining this after the fact looks worse. But I think it's better to, if you are that individual and you are indeed innocent, not to put your DNA out there and attempt to explain it, because prosecutors and police, they might not believe you and they might just want to take a chance at closing this very public case that people care about on a national level, not just a local level.
I think the only way that they wouldn't have already, you know, gotten that match, or the only way it wouldn't be someone who hasn't given their DNA yet, is if police were initially wrong about what they thought, and it was a stranger who, you know, dipped right after, just bounced out of town. And it was a college town, so that it is a possibility. People are in and out of there. but I just don't think it's likely that it was a stranger. So I think somewhere in the people close to Faith, that is who they're looking for this DNA, and they just haven't somehow gotten it yet.
Yeah, I agree. That's where the answers lie, in Faith's friend circle, in the circle of people that had access to and who knew Faith. I just think it's such a low probability that there was a stranger just randomly peeping on Faith and Karina's apartment and just happened to be watching that moment that Karina left and she happened to leave it unlocked. Like, how many coincidences would this take? And then this person just enters this apartment. And what was their objective? Like, there's no semen found in Faith insofar as we know. It looked like this was a rage-filled thing, not just a stranger thing. It seemed like there was so much anger and rage directed at Faith specifically that this almost had to be someone she knew. I mean, of course, there's a chance it could have been a stranger, but I think the probability is so low. So we mentioned earlier, I think in part one or two, that Karina and Faith were seen on CCTV leaving the Thrill nightclub. So David Bell was identified as the man talking to Faith as she was seen exiting. I think at the time I said I didn't know his name, but his name's David Bell. So Jacob Beatley, who is the man whose home Jordan McCrary and Karina went to in the early morning hours of September 7th, 2012, he was also present at Thrill that night. So Jacob was cooperative with police and answered all their questions, confirming that he had indeed been at the Thrill that night. But when asked by authorities to submit his DNA, Jacob was hesitant. He wanted to speak to his father and a lawyer. And Jacob never did submit a DNA sample to authorities. There can be any number of reasons why not. But it does seem strange, given the circumstances. We would like to believe that everyone who was questioned would submit their DNA so they could be eliminated as suspects. But unfortunately, that's just not always the case, and it does not necessarily point to guilt. So Reginald Leonard Jackson's DNA was also sought, as he'd been speaking with Faith via text message in the days leading up to her murder. For one reason or another, a strange encounter took place between Reginald and officers who were coming to question him regarding Faith's murder. Reginald decided to hightail it out of there, attempting to evade capture from authorities. It's impossible to know exactly why he reacted like this. Perhaps he was involved in illegal activity and he thought that the police visit had something to do with that. I'm merely speculating here, but I do find it to be suspicious. Reginald, when tracked down, was decidedly uncooperative, not wanting to engage with officers and distancing himself from Faith, saying he knew of her, not owning up to the fact that the two clearly had been acquainted.
So this Reginald, he did not ever give his DNA?
No, not to my knowledge. He didn't give his DNA and he pushed back a lot on police, distanced himself from Faith. But I just thought maybe if this is someone with a criminal record, I'm not 100% sure of this, but that was kind of the impression that I got, that he wasn't maybe the best guy. And so that could speak to his motivation in trying to keep a distance from police. It may not have had anything to do with Faith. It might have, but it might not have, right? So I just don't want to read too much into the way he interacted with police, because I don't know if it necessarily had anything to do with Faith or if that was just his general outlook on police.
Yeah, his reaction is definitely suspicious, but it may not be suspicious in the context of Faith's murder.
Yeah, this is just such an incredibly complex case. So what are your thoughts on what is the most likely thing that happened to Faith, Chelsea? Like, do you believe that Karina knows more than she's saying?
I think Karina, from the beginning, acted strangely, hasn't offered up any helpful information, hasn't been willing to be as forthcoming and open about Faith's murder as other people who were just as close to her. I think most of her behavior so far over the years is really suspicious and weird. And there could be perfectly logical explanations for why she's kind of hung back and maintained a low profile about it. But I think it's fair to say that it is odd the way that she's gone about discussing the case since it happened, considering she was the first there, she made the call, she was best friends with Faith, she was with Faith just a couple hours before at a club. It's all just very weird.
Yeah, it's so tough to know what happened here. There's such an interesting parallel, like you talked about earlier, how her ex-boyfriend, Ty McNeil, how he was willing to do an interview. Karina wasn't. That doesn't necessarily speak to innocence or guilt. But although Ty is a questionable past and there's some things about him that might be suspicious, I'm less inclined to believe personally that he was involved in Faith's murder. I just think that the common denominator is Karina. Do I think she necessarily murdered Faith? No, I don't. But I do think that she knows a lot more than she's saying, and she's involved in what happened in some way, shape, or form, in my personal opinion.
I think Karina's potential connection with Brandon and Brandon's connection with Faith also is interesting and kind of weird. It makes me wonder, especially after hearing the call at the club, you know, we think the voices are a bit tense. Faith had confided in another close friend that she wanted to maybe move out, maybe live separately from Karina. It makes me wonder, is there more that Karina's not saying, maybe about Faith's murder, but maybe about her relationship with Faith that may have made her look bad should she come forward with it?
Yeah, I think there's a lot that Karina's not saying, and there's probably a lot that investigators know that they're just not releasing to the public with regards to Karina and Faith's relationship. So we're just kind of left to speculate, but I do think that Brandon Edwards seems to come up a lot. Like, if we 100% know if he slept over that night, you know, a few nights prior to Faith's murder, we can't say with any high degree of certainty, but it does sound possible. And then we've got Brandon at the club. We've got Karina messaging Brandon after we know he says his warm goodbye to Faith, apparently. And then he's ignoring Karina, even though the two are supposedly hooking up. It seems like maybe there was jealousy surrounding Brandon, or maybe this had something to do with Brandon. But again, that's just my opinion. And that's just what I'm going off of, the very limited information that we have to parse through here. It just seems that Brandon, by his own words, obviously had very strong feelings for Faith, because you do not get someone's name tattooed on you. You do not speak of them in the context of, I love you and I miss you, unless you felt for them very deeply. And I'm not saying it was romantic, but it certainly kind of played that way for me. I mean, it could have been platonic, but I read it as otherwise.
Another person who keeps popping up every corner we turn in this case is Eric Tecoy Jones. He, according to Karina and the protective order she filed against him, he was allegedly abusive. He just had some scary behavior going on, had allegedly broken into their apartment. After he moved out or was possibly kicked out, he stayed in the same complex. He just had a lot of weird behavior surrounding Faith and Karina in general. And then the weird message that he posted or sent right before Faith's murder was also bizarre and a little bit suspicious. So he's definitely another person that keeps making me raise my eyebrows. And yet he was cleared with DNA, so he was not tied to the scene forensically. So now again, we're kind of right back where we started.
Again, it's possible that he could have been there. If we're eliminating somebody based solely on DNA alone, I don't know if that's enough. If they're eliminating him based on an alibi, that's a little more credible in my opinion. But I think there could be, like we said earlier, something that might not tie him via cell phone records to this. Like, say he was at the apartment he's staying at, he's sleeping, and Karina needs help, or she wants him involved, or something like that. And then Eric basically comes over, but we don't have any history of communication between the two of them at those hours. So it's possible that Eric could be tied if they're just eliminating him on DNA alone. It's just really tough to tell what they have, and it seems premature, but they may just know way more than we do. And that's why they're eliminating him. But he just keeps coming up. He's like Karina, just keeps circling back to these two individuals.
I think there's definitely a lot of information that police have that we don't. And that's why everything seems so jumbled and convoluted and we can't quite put the pieces together. But I think that police may already have those pieces.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there's probably a lot of information that police have, and I think they're very likely sharing it with Roland and Connie. And I think that's why Roland and Connie are likely so supportive of the police's initial feeling that they wanted to keep all of the information held back. And then they came to that compromise to redact and release the information. So I think because the parents are so supportive, they're clearly keeping them in the loop, which is really nice to see, because we so often don't see that with murder investigations.
This is definitely one of the very, very few cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women that I've seen where police are really on the ball with it. They really seem like they care. They really want to get this solved.
Yeah, I agree. This is one of those cases where if this was your loved one, you would absolutely hope that police would be as dedicated to investigating it as they have been to investigating Faith's murder. But for any murdered and missing Indigenous woman, this is head and shoulders above any other investigation that I have ever seen.
I agree.
Do you have any final thoughts on the case before we wrap up, Chels?
Faith Hedgepeth seemed like an absolute shining light in the world who was going to do so many good things for her community and many other communities. Probably she seemed like she had really, really big dreams. And I think that she would have achieved those. And I really, really hope that her case gets solved. And I think it can with everything we've seen lately with forensics and DNA.
So I want to thank you for joining me and helping me co-host these episodes on Faith's case.
Thank you for inviting me to co-host. This was an interesting one.
Yeah, this was definitely a deep dive. There was just so much to go through, but I'm glad you talked through it all with me because I definitely feel like with our conversations, I've got a greater understanding. And I hope that the listeners also feel like they've got a greater understanding of this case and of the evidence. So Chelsea, do you want to tell the listeners about your podcast one more time and where to find you on social media?
You can listen to Crime and Crime Again anywhere you find your podcasts. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at Crime Again Pod, Facebook, Crime and Crime Again Podcast, Instagram, Crime Again Podcast, and on TikTok at Crime Again Podcast.
I want to thank you all for listening. I would love to hear from you all if any of you have anything to say about the case, any thoughts. You can reach out to me at riddlemethatpod@gmail.com. Or I'm really, really active on Twitter, so please follow me. I'll follow you back at Podcast Riddle. And I just wanted to let you all know, if you're unaware, I don't have a Riddle Me That Patreon, but I have a Patreon with Dr. Ashley Wellman. So at the $3 level, you get early access, ad-free episodes. At the $5 level, there's a Jules and Ashley, where either Ashley will tell me a story or I'll tell Ashley a story. And it will be conspiracy theories solved, unsolved, kind of a little bit of everything. At the $10 level, there's a Path Went Chilly mini. So we'll have Robin joining us for that. So we're really, really excited. I will link that in the show notes. So until next time, stay safe and remember, accept nothing, question everything. Music by Jobbers.
Talent, talent. Talent, talent. Talentless. Talent. Talent, talentless. Talentless. Talent,
talent. Talentless talent. It's me, your host, Kylie Dills. Talentless Talent is a podcast about those with extraordinary talent. We're talking about conspiracy theories. We're talking to comedians. We're talking to painters. We are talking to those who make portraits. We're talking to dollhouse makers. We are talking to people about sports. We're talking to comedians. We're talking to sex workers. We're talking to models. We're talking to videographers. We have it all, including a very special Pickle Time. Talentless Talent is hosted by me, Kylie Dills, somebody who has no talent. So be sure to tune it in every Thursday. I'll catch you there, my Talentless Talent babes. We're having a good time.
Talentless Talent.
Talentless Talent.
Talentless Talent.
Talentless Talent.
With Kylie Dills.